Coming up on this week's book show, Salman Rushdie is one of the world's most renowned authors. Midnight's Children is considered one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. The Satanic Verses brought him notoriety. His latest is Quixote, a modern, very American retelling of Don Quixote. Sir Salman Rushdie, on this week's book show, Tuesday afternoons at 3, Thursday evenings at 8:30, and anytime via podcast or at WAMC.org. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Salman Rushdie is one of the world's most renowned authors. Midnight's Children, about the partition of India, is considered one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. It was the Satanic Verses that brought him notoriety. Now, as he did in his previous novel, The Golden Hour, he tackles contemporary politics and culture in his latest, Quixote. It's a modern, very American retelling of Don Quixote. Inspired by the Cervantes classic, Sam Duchamp, mediocre writer of spy thrillers, creates Quixote, a courtly, addled salesman obsessed with television who falls impossible love with a TV star. Together with his imaginary son, Sancho, Quixote sets off on a quest across America to prove worthy of her hand. Meanwhile, his creator, in a midlife crisis, has equally urgent challenges of his own. The new book has already been shortlisted for the prestigious Booker Prize before a live audience at the Fisher Center for Performing Arts on the campus of Bard College. Please join me in welcoming Sir Salman Rushdie. It's a delight to have you here. It's a delight to talk about this novel. It struck me the last time you were on our program, we talked about The Golden House. In that book, you wrote about, well, New York City. It was all about Manhattan and New York City and how the world was kind of going to hell. Now, you take a road trip and the world's still going to hell.
Well, now it's gone to hell.
Yeah, it's gone to hell. And the idea of you taking this road trip, when did that start to... Did you start to think about percolate and say, oh, let's go do a road trip?
That's almost immediately, I mean, like almost the day I finished the last novel, because that novel almost entirely takes place in the 212 area code. When I finished the book, I thought, now you have to leave town. And I actually thought, before I knew anything about this book, I thought I might do a nonfiction book in which I got in a car and drove and just went across the country to see what I could see. You know, Quixote in the novel does this with his imaginary teenage son. And my younger son at that time was 20. And so I thought I'd ask him. I said, you want to drive across America? And he said, yes, he was up for it. But then he paused and he said, Dad, are you going to drive? I said, you know, I've been driving since before you were born, kid. And he said, no, I don't think you're going to drive. So I said, how about if you drive? He said, yes, then I'll do it. And so we actually thought about doing this for real. And then there's a certain point, I just thought, you know, I would do it better if I was making it up. It would just be better than reportage. And so I fired him.
Do you feel that way in most cases, that it's better if you make it up?
Yeah, because that's what I do. I make things up for a living. And I'm better at that than at journalism.
Informed by your experiences, of course.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been living in America now for just under 20 years. And I've been coming to America since I was in my early 20s. So I've been around a lot. And a lot of the places, I mean, the book is, you know, it starts, I mean, when we meet Quichotte, he's about to be fired from his job as a pharmaceutical salesman, and he's in a motel in Gallup, New Mexico. And then he travels rather erratically around the country towards New York, and then it goes away again. And most of those places I've been to, or I've been to places very like them. You know, there are one or two places which are sort of fictionalized versions of real places. Like, you know, there is not a town in New Jersey called Beringer where people turn into mastodons. You know, not yet.
Yeah, there could be, right?
There could be. And there's at one point, there's a sort of violent moment in a town in Kansas called Beautiful. Well, there is not a town in Kansas called Beautiful, but when I was digging into the world of the book, there was this random shooting that took place in a town in Kansas called Olathe, in which two Indian American men who were like software engineers were shot by some crazy guy, and one of them died and one of them survived. And I was following that story, and then I dug into it and I discovered that Olathe is a Native American word meaning beautiful. And so I thought, okay, I'll just have this town which isn't quite the real town, so that I'm not limited by the actual news story. I can use my imagination, you know. So there are places which are like variant forms of places that really mm-hmm. exist. And some of the places I do know and I've been to, and there they are in the book.
You mentioned Gallup, New Mexico, population 21,678. You tell us the population of all these towns.
Everywhere,
made up,
yeah.
Yes.
It's a kind of gag. Where it came from in a sort of left-handed way was I remember reading Andy Warhol's diaries. And Andy Warhol's diaries, every time he goes anywhere, he tells you how much it costs. So he says, you know, took a cab uptown to see Elaine, $7.50 with tip. Came back down to Seabees, $9 with tip. And I just thought it was so hilarious that he priced everything. You know, his whole life had a price attached. And I thought, well, I don't want to do that because he did that. So I thought instead I'd just do populations, that every time they arrive anywhere, the novel tells you the population, which sometimes is like five people and sometimes it's New York City.
It does tell us a lot about the town, and I was going to bring this up later, but we might as well bring it up now, which you're writing much of the book, you're writing about the opioid addiction.
Yes.
The crisis that we have in this country.
Which is worse in small towns than in big cities in some way.
Right, and that is what's so fascinating is because you see it affecting these towns in the middle of the country. It certainly has its impact in urban areas, but you certainly see its
deadly
effect.
No, it's colossal in these small towns where entire communities can become dependent on these things. And what I felt was there's a political way of thinking about this, which is corrupt big pharma and doctors who play along with them in return for bribes. But the thing that I really felt was that what it showed was something about pain and isolation, you know, something about really quite a lonely country in which people felt very isolated from one another and in all kinds of, you know, inner pain. And we're looking, I don't mean physical pain, I mean emotional pain. And looking for some kind of succor, some kind of solace, and reaching out to these very dangerous things to try and find it. And then what happens, before they know it, suddenly they're an addict, you know? And then it's not about your sadness, it's about being a junkie, and it changes. Yeah, I mean, Quichotte, the central character, is somebody who starts out selling these things to doctors. And of course, they have a legitimate use. So he's selling this spray that his cousin's company has invented, which is a spray version of fentanyl. Fentanyl, you know, is the opioid that killed Prince. It's the most powerful one. And it's under the tongue. If you spray it under the tongue, it's even more powerful because it gets into your system faster. And there's a real reason for it. The real reason for it is to relieve pain in terminal cancer patients. That's what it's for. And for in that use, it's fantastically valuable. But then, of course, crooked pharmaceutical entrepreneurs and bent doctors arrange to make it available to people who don't need it because they're not dying. And then it's very dangerous.
Let me make this the first time throughout the evening that I will tell / remind people of how funny this novel is.
Yes. It's a comedy.
It really is. And it's a joyride. It really is.
Yeah.
So now having made that point, let me say, do you see a connection between the fact that we are drugging ourselves and the fact that our world has gone to hell?
Well, I think that's not unconnected. It's not the only reason, but, you know, there it is. What I wanted to do was to look at something that I take very seriously, which is a society in a kind of crisis and very divided and very at odds with itself. And then to write about it kind of against the grain, to write about it playfully and lightly. And I remember reading essays by one of the writers I most admired, the Italian writer Italo Calvino, who had essays about what he thought were the great literary values. He has an essay called Lightness, and he has an essay called Swiftness. And I thought, you know, exactly. That's exactly what I want, the book to have this quality of lightness and swiftness, so that it doesn't get bogged down in misery. It moves right along, speeds right along like this daffy old guy in his Chevy Cruze motoring across America. So the note of the novel is comic, but the material is often dark.
The idea, the breezy way that the narrator will say, we'll find out about this
in a
little bit.
Mm.
You just wait, and this will become clear in a little bit. That, of course, that obviously has you turning pages furiously, but also it gives it a nice, quick quality to it.
Well, I've always been very interested in techniques of oral storytelling. I don't just mean professional, how people tell each other stories, you know, just socially. You know, if you have a story to tell someone, you might not tell it necessarily in linear order. You know, you might diverge because you say something and it makes you think, well, there's this other bit that I have to tell you and I'll come back to this, so hang around because we'll be back. And that's how people actually tell each other stories. And I thought there's something to be learned from that. The most enjoyable, in a way, the clearest way of telling a story doesn't always have to be chronological. It doesn't always have to be sequential. It can have digressions. It can have parentheses. You know, those can all be part of the pleasure of the storytelling.
He could not at first fathom how such an eccentric notion had lodged in his brain and why it insisted so vehemently on being written that he had no choice but to start work. Then, as he thought about it further, he began to understand that in some fashion that he did not as yet fully grasp Quichotte, the loner in search of love, the loser nobody who believed himself capable of winning the heart of a queen, had been with him all his life, a shadow self he had glimpsed from time to time in the corner of his eye, but had not had the courage to confront. Instead, he had written his commonplace fictions of the secret world. Am I correct in my vague memory of your work that this is the first time you've actually written about writing?
Yeah, because I sort of disapproved of it. There are all these books in which writers invent writers who write about writing. And I think, you know, stop it. Just tell your story, you know. And then in this book, it was not part of the plan of the book. I mean, I thought I was telling the story of this daffy old pharmaceutical salesman who falls in love with somebody on television and decides he's going to travel across the country to win her hand in this kind of absurd way, you know. And I thought that would be the book. And then this other character showed up who I'd realized was the ostensible author of the other storyline. So then I'm writing about a writer who's writing about, and I thought, what am I doing? I disapprove of this. So I was very uncertain about it. And I just reserved the right in my own mind that I would try it out, and if I didn't like it, I would take it out. And so I worked on it kind of provisionally to see what it had in it. And then to my pleasure, really, and surprise, these two storylines began to merge, and they began to inform each other. They began to, I hope, illuminate each other. And then I thought, this is kind of interesting. Because he, the author, has problems in his real life. He has an estranged son. He has a sister with whom he's quarreled. And he's getting on a bit, and he wants reconciliation, and he hopes for forgiveness, and so on. And then we find that variations of that life, which is his life, are finding their way into his fiction in a different way, you know, not the same way. And then I thought, this is kind of interesting to say, this is how the stuff of a real life can be transmuted into art. And this is, in a way, a relationship between life and art, and that's quite interesting to explore.
I have to ask this question then. You write, he would have to reveal himself alongside his subject, for the tale and the teller were yoked together by race, place, generation, and circumstance. Mm. Did you feel that way?
Well, you know, I'm hiding behind him because I'm writing about a writer writing about a character. But clearly, one of the things that you will feel as a reader reading this thing is who's writing the writer, you know, and how much of his emotion and all that is invested in the character that he's created. And I'm just going to let you guess the answer to that. No, the thing that that I and the ostensible author and the character all have in common is that we all come from the same place. We all grew up in the same neighborhood in Bombay, as it then was called. And we all, in different ways, made lives in the West. Different lives. That we all had that experience.
Why was it important for you to have that commonality?
Well, one of the things the book talks about in its funny, serious way is death. It talks about the end of life. It talks about mortality. And both Quichotte and his author are having to face that subject. And, you know, I mean, I'm not 150 yet, but I am 72. And you begin to think about it. So, yes, of course, I'm thinking about it too. So, and I'm thinking about it through the characters. But you see, what I think is wonderful about being a novelist is once you've made your characters and once they're properly alive in your head, you really think through them. You know, you're thinking, how would they think? What would they think about this? How would they react? What are their emotions? What are their feelings about all these things? And so it becomes more interesting to me to explore what they think than to feed my thoughts into their heads. If I wanted to write about me, I would write nonfiction. You know, the point about fiction is to inhabit other human beings and to try and understand them and make them live.
Sir Salman Rushdie is our guest. The name of the new novel is Quichotte. It is published by Random House. What do you believe Cervantes was the message he was trying to get across? And ultimately, how that parallels the message that you were trying to get across.
Well, you know, Cervantes had a kind of pretty rough beginning as a writer. I mean, he came to writing life late. He'd had quite a rough life. He'd fought in wars. He'd lost the use of an arm. His early books were not successful. And then he came up with this book in which he wanted to say that a lot of the books that people read these days are junk. And not only are they junk, they're not my book. Not only are they junk and not my book, but they're actually bad for you. And so, you know, he has this character, this minor country figure who decides he's a knight because he reads books about knights. And it literally addles his brain. You know, all the books he's read kind of drive him nuts. That's where the great novel takes off. And I thought, well, if he was around now, what would he be protesting about? What would he be saying in our time is bad for us in the way that the junk chivalric literature of the 16th and 17th century was at that time? And I mean, I thought in the end, probably television, and in particular, reality television, and its ugly sister, the internet, somewhere there. And I mean, I don't watch reality television. This is not my field. But then
Boy,
I had.
It seems like you know it for this book, though.
Then I had to.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, this is one of the rods you make for your own back. You invent a character, then you've got to do your research, you know. So I had to watch.
You got a whole bachelor history in there.
Yes, yes, and bachelorette. Let's be fair. And, you know, I mean, just disgraceful amounts of Bravo television. And, And I could fully understand how this would rot the brain. Mm. I felt my brain beginning to rot.
The idea of brothers and sisters and fathers and sons is, as you touched on a moment ago, is done really in double.
Yeah, because in both of the storylines, there's a brother and sister relationship that needs work, that's damaged in some way. And there's a father-son relationship in both, which is strained in different ways. And the subject of forgiveness is very important in the book, because I think what I was trying to say is that now we have these families. These are diasporic families. They're separated by continents and oceans in the way that so many families are now. One consequence of that is just the distance can create personal distance, emotional distance. And then there can be old, imagined, or real insults or offenses given or taken that also become distancing in families. And the question is, can those things be healed? Can forgiveness come into that story and reunite the things that are broken? That's really, I mean, the story of the novel, ostensible story of the novel, is this quest story. But underneath it, there's this story about people trying to heal their relationships and see if love will be stronger than their injuries.
For me, it harkened back to Midnight's Children because it was so family-based.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just because, you know, if you come from India, the family is the center of everything. You know, it's just the center of life. And so for me, the subject of family has always been very close to the center of what I'm thinking and doing. And in this case, I thought, these are damaged families. These are families in which things have gone wrong. And yet, you know, they are blood relations, and the question is whether they can come together again. And as I say, there's these four stories, two father-sons, two brother-sister stories, and they don't all end the same way, you know, because that would be dumb. Some of them work out better than others, but it's a kind of inquiry into that subject about how we are with our closest people.
Quixote's son, Sancho, I love that character.
I'm so happy. You know, it's been very pleasurable to me that Sancho appears to be the character that everybody digs.
You write an amazing 17-year-old.
Well, I'm very proud of him, you know, but you never know in a book when you offer it to the reader, you know, what will readers latch onto, and et cetera. And I'm very pleased that Sancho appears to be the kid that everybody hangs onto, because he's born yesterday, but he's born at the age of 17. His father, Quixote, never had a wife, he's always wanted a child, and because he's nuts, he thinks that you can literally wish upon a star. So he goes to a meteor shower, of the Perseid meteor shower near Devil's Tower, Wyoming. And he wishes for a child, and the child appears in the passenger seat of the Chevy Cruze. Teenage, not baby, teenager, with all the bad behavior of a teenager.
The U.S. is broken in this novel. The U.K. is broken in this novel. India is broken in this novel.
Well, they're all in trouble anyway. I mean, they're obviously very different places, and they have different narratives, but the thing I think they have in common is that people are being seduced by a false narrative of the past. Now, in India, this very popular government has basically been selling the Hindu majority a myth about this golden age of Hinduism, which predated the arrival of the Muslim invaders, you know, and how basically those people came in and ruined everything. And if we could just get back to, as they say, the rule of Ram, the rule of the god Ram, then things would be better. But the British, of course, or at least the English, let's be clear, it's not the Scots or the Irish, the English have been sold this story about kind of England's glory, you know, and how it was before there were all these awful Europeans and brown people. And if we could just get rid of all those people, we could have that country of straw boaters and punts and, you know, cream teas. That could be, you know, cream teas for everyone.
And meanwhile, how did they get that cream tea?
Exactly. They never discuss colonialism. They never discuss raping the wealth of half quarter of the world. No, no. And then here, you know, we have the Red Hat. And the question of the Red Hat that I want to ask the Red Hat people is when was that, the greatness to which we now aspire? if we want to make America great again, when was that? Was it in the 20th century? If so, was it before the Second World War, after it? Was it during Vietnam? Was it further back? Was it when there was still slavery? Was it before women had the vote? Was it before the civil rights movement? When was it? And the question is, of course, irrelevant, because the point about the Golden Age is that it's a myth, that there never was such a time. And that's true in all three places. People are being sold an idea of a golden past, which is a fiction. And that fiction is being used to determine what's happening in the present. And that's, you know, if you're a fiction writer, you worry about it when people start using fiction in that way, because it's an improper use of fiction.
You had a death sentence put on you for your fiction writing by a radical. Can't you see that we're not too far from that when we talk about the enemy of the people and the censorship and a celebrity who says something and then suddenly they're trashed? I'm not comparing the two. Obviously, you went through far more, but it is scary.
Totalitarianism is scary. I don't want to overstate things. I don't believe this country is anywhere near a totalitarian state, or the United Kingdom. India might be a bit closer. But step one is to make people disbelieve in the news. Step one is you are being lied to. Everybody is lying to you. Step two is I'm the only one telling you the truth. So step three is don't believe any of those people. Trust in me, and I will tell you the truth. That's how you get down the road to dictatorship. And we're three steps down that road.
And with that said, and you write about that country, those countries, this country, in your novel, this book still manages, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, to have a pretty happy ending.
It depends how you read the ending.
You wanted it that way, though.
I mean, I'm interested that that's how you see it. It's a little ambiguous,
the
ending. So it's a question of how you feel about it. And I'd be interested to know, actually, because I'm not sure what I think about the ending. On some days, I feel cheerful about it, and on some days, it feels darker. It's deliberately on a knife edge. Maybe that's the knife edge we're on.
Well, maybe that's what I mean. It seems appropriate for what we're in.
As a writer, as a person, I have no time for despair. You know, despair leads to bad writing. And it's a bad project for life as well. Things are changeable. I mean, I think one of the things, you know, I was not a student of literature. I was a student of history. And one of the things that studying history teaches you is that history doesn't run on tram lines. It makes very sudden changes. And so you can't assume that because things feel bad in a certain way at a certain moment, that it will inevitably go on going that way. It could go somewhere worse, but it could also go somewhere better. The point is, it will not go in the way that you think it'll go.
Salman Rushdie's new novel is Quichotte. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or online at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program in partnership with Oblong Books and Music. This edition was recorded before a live audience at the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of Bard College in Annandale and Hudson, New York. It is a great pleasure to have Sir Salman Rushdie on our program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Book Marcus for next week, and thanks for listening to The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.